you know, they want it either all the way up, extended, or all the way down. It works, which is nice, because sometimes, you have that, you don't have to swing back and forth with the rubber duck back and forth, you know, and it's only a little longer than a regular rubber duck. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, once you've got a telescoping antenna, you get a couple of advantages. Number one, usually it's bigger than the rubber duck, which allows you to have the center of radiation higher above the ground, and on VHF, extra altitude always helps. And you can also start experimenting with the length of the whip to see which bands it works on the best on your particular radio. So it's a lot of fun to experiment with that. And stop worrying about damaging the final stage. Almost impossible. But even if you did damage the stage, the final stage, because it was a 1985 Handy Talkie, which had a delicate final stage. Again, a guy like Andy, the B2CDL, could fix that for you in half an hour to replace that final stage. So it's not a showstopper. Every one of the components and every one of the things we own, with rare exception, are replaceable sub-assemblies. And just because you open up the case doesn't mean that you're going to void the warranty and that there's a year's supply of food with a scorpion inside. Stop worrying. By the way, some people are saying that they're writing carefully down, they're taking notes on everything they hear on the TechNet, and if you happen to miss something, know that all of it is being recorded for the last, I'm double-checking here, ever since 2006, so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the last 6 years, essentially every one of the TechNets is recorded. You go to the website of Mike Perry, KC2NJI, that website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tv. You go there and you'll find that you can go to whatever Sunday, whatever month, whatever year for the last 6 years, and you can listen to the TechNets. And each one of the TechNets usually appear on that website in about 1, 2, 3 days. In other words, this particular TechNet you're hearing tonight, which is TechNet number 1,345 of my listing technique, most likely by Tuesday that will be there and you can play it back. Mike, let me drop. Mike mentions that you might be curious as to how many people listen to the TechNet by way of the website. And Mike mentions that 198,000 people have done that. Well, there's a little bit more than just our TechNet there, but so we believe we're one of the major reasons people go there. There's other things that Mike has been recording over the years, but now the main thing he's recording is the Metroplex TechNet in New Jersey and the Long Island TechNet of Limerick. 198,000 hits he has had for that material. So there's lots of ways you can play back what we've said with all of our errors, with all of the goofs. Okay, this is the more serious portion of the TechNet, where we dig a little deeper. And it doesn't please everybody, we know that. And if so, you can always go, you've got 800 channels on that 2-meter radio. You don't have to listen to this particular one if you don't want to listen to it. But as I've said before, the real ham radio operators, they've got a built-in scientist inside, in my opinion, that wants to know a little bit more, sometimes at the molecular level, what is really happening. One of the things that Wesley sent me this week was a recording of a Russian scientist bouncing two balls. And he had a heavy ball and a light ball. And each one of them bounces with reasonable coefficient of restitution, as it's called. In other words, how high it will bounce on a hard surface. But when he puts the light ball on top of the heavy ball, and this is a classic experiment. It's been done for decades. You put the light ball on top of the heavy ball, and you allow them to both go in together onto the bounce. The light ball will bounce tremendously higher compared to the height you dropped it from. And there's a classic explanation for that. So I think this is one of the six questions that Wesley is going to have us get involved with tonight. I'll turn it over to Wesley now before I give an explanation on that one. N2XJN.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2XJN, our local scientist, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Good evening, everyone. N2XJN. I have a question in regards to that subject. One of them is why the upper ball go over the point of being dropped originally. So, If you drop one ball only, it never jumps more than from the level that you dropped it. That's a very easy explanation for that. The second question is why the upper ball jumping much above the level of two of these balls rebounds distance added together. So, there is no answer. And that scientist calculated all vectors and he couldn't find mathematical explanation for this phenomenon. Now, the third question would be, can we base on this concept build untapped energy device theoretically? And the fourth question would be, can we send an object to this space using this phenomenon? And that would be all for this subject number one that we're discussing.
Yeah, this is a real good experiment. As I said, it's a classic. It's been done for years. When something bounces, whether it be the cue ball on a billiard table, or whether it be a steel BB on a steel surface, you know, or a ball bearing, or your basketball or whatever, the higher the quality of the bouncing object, the so-called coefficient of restitution, as you get to real high quality bouncing object, and a steel ball bearing on a steel surface comes very close, very high coefficient of restitution, it becomes what's called an elastic collision. By comparison to an elastic collision, you can have a inelastic collision. If I threw a bullet, so to speak, at a chunk of clay, that collision is an extremely elastic collision. Deformation of the clay takes place, energy absorption, and funny things happening. But let's now restrict ourselves to the perfect kind of collision, elastic collision, a perfect bounce. And if you go to a website that's a Wikipedia, if you simply, on your Google search engine, if you write down the word elastic collision plus wiki, W-I-K-I, elastic collision plus wiki, and you go to the very first site that's there, you get a beautiful set of pictures. It's a moving picture diagram. You have to go down. The first thing you see on the page is what happens when air molecules are making perfect elastic collisions, air molecules inside of a box. And they made some of them red and most of them are blue, and you can see what happens. But you page down on that page, and the first diagram you'll see on the bottom is a blue and a black box moving at velocity V and touching each other. And these are all elastic collisions. The first one is a moving and a stationary box. The second is a two moving boxes moving toward each other.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So with these black and blue boxes, you'll see the first collision is one non-moving and one moving. The second one is two equal boxes in nearly equal velocity. The third one is two boxes moving in the same direction. Go a little bit further down the page, you'll find the fourth diagram, which is a mass of two boxes moving at velocity V, hitting a mass of one box moving at velocity V, and what happens. And as you study these diagrams, you'll find out that in the case of elastic collisions, Mother Nature says no energy is lost. Therefore, two things must be conserved. Number one, you must conserve momentum. Momentum is velocity times mass. So the velocity times mass of each of the individual objects before the impact, and the velocity plus mass times mass of the resultants must add up to be the exact same number. Momentum must be conserved. All collisions, even inelastic collisions, will conserve momentum. Let me drop. But the magic of thoroughly elastic collisions is not only is momentum conserved, but kinetic energy is conserved. What is kinetic energy? Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. In other words, if you know the amount of mass that's moving, and you take the velocity of that mass and square it and multiply the two together. That product is called total kinetic energy, and it's in units of joules, joules of kinetic energy. So you add up the joules of kinetic energy of each of the objects that are about to have a collision, and after the collision, you'll find out that there are certain velocities of certain masses of what happens after the collision, and the total kinetic energy of the result must be the same as the total kinetic energy of what went into it. You study it from that point of view, and you look at the fourth diagram, where you have two different objects of two different sizes coming together, you'll discover that the lighter object flies away at ridiculously high velocity. And when you go through the mathematics, you'll see that it is conserving kinetic energy as well as momentum. And although it looks crazy to the eye, there is no real magic on that one, Wesley. The mathematics of the way they presented this is not as easy as it could be to understand. But with the words I've just given, maybe it helps a little bit. N2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
N2XJN, I understand that. We can't break the thermodynamics laws, but we can. Can we do more work with the same energy input? If we have a rebounding of the upper ball at much, much higher distances as the distance of two balls drop together, that means you drop both of these balls approximately the same distance. The scientist is asking the question, can we send the object using this phenomena into the space? Back to you.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. I think the answer is almost no, Wesley, and for the reason that if I can create enough velocity, the escape velocity from the Earth is something like 7 kilometers per second? I think it's 7 kilometers per second is the escape velocity of the Earth. If an object is moving above the atmosphere at 7 kilometers per second, then if it's directed away from the center of the Earth, it'll move forever and always be moving away from the Earth and never come back. However, if there was no atmosphere on this Earth, and I move something at the surface, 7 kilometers per second, escape velocity, yes, that object goes away, never comes back. With the atmosphere, I've got a problem. You'll notice that when you blast off with your space shuttle or your Saturn V or any of our other boosters, you notice that in the beginning of that mission, not only are you moving slow because you haven't applied the thrust for a long enough period of time and you haven't accelerated fast enough yet, but still you're going through the atmosphere at relatively low speeds, only a few times the speed of sound on the way up. Coming back down, you first hit the atmosphere at something like 25 times the speed of sound, and the leading edge of your aircraft will glow at the 2,000, 3,000 degrees centigrade. Ridiculously high temperatures are occurring because of atmospheric drag. Let me drop. And by the way, I'm using those words lightly. Everybody calls it atmospheric drag. It is not atmospheric drag. Essentially, none of those air molecules are striking the leading edge of that wing. They look like they are. They are not. You're seeing a continuous compression effect. The leading edge of those aircrafts coming and the leading edge of your meteor hitting the Earth's atmosphere gets hot because of compression, not friction. 99% of what goes on is compression, not friction. The same phenomena that makes the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot when you're blowing up a tire. That's another whole situation here. But so even if I had, by some means, I've got a real strong spring, I've got two balls or whatever, and I want to launch something at 7 kilometers per second at the Earth's surface, and I want it to go into space, it's got to get through the atmosphere at that velocity, and you're going to get a ridiculous amount of drag and heating, and you're not going to make it. You're going to melt your object, and it's going to be slowed down by so much of the atmosphere, you can't do it. If you're going to bounce these two balls, and you're going to do that experiment above the atmosphere, yes, you could do that. There's a lot more going on here. There's another piece of information I'm going to give you after we pick up Paul first. WS2N with your question, K2RIW in the tech net.
I just want to give you another example of that same effect, but in reality, if you're standing on a scaffold, oh, maybe 20 feet, 30 feet high, let's put the number 30 feet high, and you have, let's say, a piece of pipe, maybe that piece of pipe is 2 feet long, you know, a scheduled 40, or roughly almost a quarter of an inch thick pipe. But the diameter of it is, say, 1 inch. It's a 1 inch pipe and 2 feet long with a cap on the end. And you put water in there, fill it up, either halfway or even all the way to the top, doesn't matter. You take that thing and you drop it off the... You could either dump the water and let the water hit the ground, and you'll watch the water hit the ground, and the water doesn't seem to jump up at all. But if you take that pipe, chopped down, facing down, with that water in that inside that pipe, and the top part is open, let me drop it. And you drop that, and the cap part hits the concrete first down below. Where do you think that water is going to go? How high do you think that water might get? Do you think it might go halfway up, 10 feet, 5 feet? What do you think is going to come all the way up to the top of the scaffold and get your eyes wet, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, in that example, you set up a beautiful shockwave in that water inside that Schedule 40 pipe. And my guess is that water can come squirting out of that pipe considerably higher than where you're standing. Is that true, Paul? Sounds to me like you've actually witnessed this experiment. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, many, many times. For instance, in fire prevention sprinkler system, before you see all those nice, nice shiny heads on the buildings, you know, as you go through the building, before the building is done, they have these drops in there, and sometimes they're 18 inches long or 2 feet long, whatever they might be. They're just in there temporarily. And they run a test on the whole system and make sure the system is good. And then when they're good, all these pieces have to come out, and eventually the nice chrome shiny heads go back in, go in. But as you're taking these things out, what we generally do is we pour the water either, you know, onto the dirt if it's a dirt area, but you'll have pails of water. You could pour the water right into the pail of water before you throw these pipes off the end, because you find out very quickly, like sometimes this water is very dirty, you know, you drop it off and it comes right back up, it'll hit you right in the eyes, it's very dirty, muddy water, get all over your clothes, you learn real quick, Dick, but it's an amazing example put into a practical experience of what Wesley brought up. Back to you, Dick.
If that Schedule 40 pipe was a thoroughly non-deformable object, and there's nothing in there but a column of water with a cap on the bottom of the pipe and it hits the concrete, in theory, that water can't come up any higher than you're standing. But because the pipe is a deformable object, because of the instant of impact, the water is being compressed, the steel pipe is being compressed, there's a huge spring in that object that's not obvious to the casual observer. And almost all of that springing action of the compression of the Schedule 40 steel pipe, almost all of that momentum and kinetic energy, a high percentage of that gets coupled into the water and the shock wave of the water and the compression of the water, and the water comes squirting out of that pipe with all of that extra energy. The energy of the drop of the pipe is being coupled into the water in that system. That's part of what's going on, and that one is what I believe, and we'll eventually confirm that. But let me give you a little bit more of a feeling for what's going on with those two balls that are bouncing in that experiment that you've mailed to us, Wesley. Let me drop. At first, this is going to sound a little bit disconnected, but you'll suddenly see the relationship. you can take almost every one of the scientific people you work with and ask them, why does the bottom of my bicycle pump get hot when I pump up a tire? To a man, they will tell you, I've studied this equation in thermodynamics in school, and it says PV equals NRT. Pressure times volume is a constant times the new temperature, if you know what I mean. The volume and the temperature is a product that gets conserved. So you're compressing the gas, and the PV equals NRT equation tells you that the gas must get hotter. The equation tells you how much. Doesn't tell you why. Doesn't tell you how. The air molecules that are in the bottom of that pump are considerably hotter than the air molecules that went into the pump before you started pumping. Higher temperature of the air molecules means they're moving faster. The air molecules that are in the room with you right now are moving at 500 meters per second. I don't blame you for being skeptical. They are moving that fast. You can look that up. There's a lot of places where you can confirm that. The air molecules in the bottom of that pump are maybe moving with 50% more kinetic energy. They're moving faster. They started off at 500 meters per second, and as I push down on the plunger of the pump, the air molecules in that pump are now moving maybe 50% faster than 500 meters per second. Where the hell did all that extra velocity come from? Is an extremely prevalent question. You ask the average guy who thinks he knows science, tell me why. To a man, I don't think one guy in 50 can answer that question. To which I say, why in...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Why in the world has no one ever asked that question before? Why were they not curious enough about that? And I'm moving that pump down, the plunger, with my handle on that pump, I'm moving it down at maybe 1 meter per second. Maybe half a meter, maybe a quarter of a meter per second. And the air molecules in that pump are now moving 50% faster than 500 meters per second. Where the heck did all of that extra velocity come from? Believe it or not, you did it. You did it when you moved that plunger. And your next question is going to be, how in the world can I move the plunger that slow and yet get all that extra velocity? And the answer is the ping pong paddle effect. And it happens a million times per second. When those air molecules are moving 500 meters per second, they are striking the plunger of that pump millions of times per second. Tremendous number are striking the plunger. On each individual strike, they're picking up energy. The best example I give of this is that I've got a big fat ping pong paddle, and I'm moving it toward you. You and I are playing ping pong. I'm moving the paddle toward you at 2 meters per second. You have thrown the ping pong ball, a perfect ping pong ball, you have thrown it to me at 3 meters per second. So those two objects are about to strike each other. The ping pong ball, 3 meters per second, is coming toward me. It's about to strike the paddle in my hand, and that paddle is moving toward you at 2 meters per second. You ask every one of the engineers you know, how fast is the ping pong ball moving afterwards? 90% of them will say 5 meters per second. 3 meters per second, the ping pong ball is coming toward me. 2 meters per second, the ping pong paddle is going toward you. They strike with a closing velocity of 5 meters per second. Therefore, the ping pong ball is moving 5 meters per second compared to the table. 90-some-odd percent of the engineers will give you that answer. Dead wrong. The answer is 7 meters.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The answer is 7 meters per second, very similar to these two balls in Wesley's experiment that he brought to our attention. The reason for that is, yes, the closing velocity between the ball and the paddle, paddle is moving 2, ball is moving 3, closing velocity is 5. Yes, the ball leaves the paddle at 5 meters per second compared to the paddle. But the paddle is moving at 2. It gets another 2 added. The ball is moving at 7. The bottom line is, however fast you move the paddle, double that velocity, and that's about to be added to the ball if the ball is good enough in quality. Once you realize that those air molecules in your pump started off at 500 meters per second, and they're striking the paddle millions of times per second, each individual air molecule. Although you're moving the paddle, the piston on the pump rather slowly, whatever velocity you're moving the piston at, double that, and you're adding it to each one of those air molecules that strike the piston. I'm using the word strike in quotes. It doesn't really hit, but we won't go there right now. And on each individual strike, double the velocity the piston is being added, and they're striking that piston millions of times per second. By the time you push that piston down in that pump, those air molecules in the bottom of that pump are moving something like 50% faster than they were before. And they started off at 500 meters per second. And the air in that pump is now up to 250 degrees Fahrenheit, if you know what I mean. You buy the right kind of a science project where you push the piston down kind of fast with a small piece of paper in the bottom of the piston, and the piece of paper will instantaneously ignite because you've exceeded the thermal ignition temperature of paper just by pushing the piston down with the air that's in that piston, if you know what I mean. So it's conservation of momentum plus conservation of kinetic energy, and although that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Although that double ball bouncing experiment looks very striking, and it looks like something magic is taking place, if you go deep enough into what's happening, I think there is no magic there, Wesley. Although, I will admit that 90% of the people looking at that will say, wow, something real magic is going on here. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Mr. Wizard. Okay, I do understand your explanation. I agree with it. The professor, the Russian PhD, agrees with your explanation as well. But the problem of this gentleman is that he exactly knows that in the center of the momentum frame, at any time, the velocities of two bodies are in opposite direction with the magnets inversely proportional to the masses. He knows it. And in elastic collision, these magnitudes do not change. And of course, the direction may change depending on the shapes of the bodies at the point of impact. But he found practically, see, I spoke with the gentleman that knows that professor. I had the time to, I didn't approach the professor. He found approximately 150% the distance of that smaller ball jumping in is over the mathematical explanation. So he says, okay, due to the mathematics, it should not jump. So he was trying to use the thermal factors, at the air, the speed of the air, and whatsoever. So that's the only what I wanted to point. But it's an interesting experiment. Back to you.
When you bounce the heavy ball all by itself, it comes to a certain altitude. When you have the lighter ball on top of the heavy ball and you bounce the two together as a pair, you'll discover that the heavy ball on the second experiment doesn't go up anywhere near as high as it did when it was all by itself. Much of the kinetic energy of the larger ball got coupled into the kinetic energy of the smaller ball. And it's a mysterious looking process until you really get down to the molecular level almost as to what's happening. It's the macroscopic level. I am fairly convinced that if you knew the mass and altitude of each of the balls before they were dropped, you calculate at the instant of impact what is their momentum and kinetic energy, and after the impact, when the small ball is now moving up real fast and the large ball is not moving up as fast, if you calculate the brand new momentums and the brand new kinetic energies, I am guessing that the total kinetic energy after the impact of the double ball is not greater than the total kinetic energy that you started off with. It's a very exciting looking experiment, but I think if the mathematics with the right directions, you got to be careful with the directions on this one. If you do everything in the right directions, I think the math will add up correctly. If not, we'd be launching an awful lot of our rockets this way, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Wesley. Go ahead, Glenn. Wonder if you've seen that experiment. I think, Wesley, I think, mailed you a copy of it. You probably looked at the YouTube video. Is that true? You got it, Glenn.
Yes, I have, Dick. And, see, there's a couple of interesting things that are taking place there. One is you have two dissimilar masses, and, you know, initially, and if they initially started off with similar elasticity, the balls basically bounce the same amount. When one is resting on top of the other one, the amount of elasticity, the energy from the from the larger mass gets transferred into the smaller mass. Therefore, its velocity and its after impact, all the, from that mass times its initial velocity gets transferred to the smaller ball. But what's also interesting is that if you change the elasticity of the first heavy mass to, let's say, a piece of lead, and then you put the rubber ball on top of a heavy piece of lead and then drop the ball with that, the ball is really going to take off, because now the energy from that elasticity coupling into the little ball will really take off, because now you have the mass of a heavier object that isn't going to move as much after the impact. And I think impact is really what we're looking at here. That wouldn't be a very, very good way to launch rockets, because it would have to be able to withstand the shock of that impact before that energy is transferred. K4IW, KC2, QIQ.
That was a good one.
A buddy of mine was putting electronics into a cannon shell. And when that gunpowder of the cannon gets ignited, and that shockwave happens, I think the numbers were something like 7,000 G's. His electronics that was inside of that cannon shell had to survive 7,000 G's at the instant of takeoff. And believe it or not, that's doable, as tough as that is. And that, as big as that number is, you take your handheld calculator and assume now that you're walking across the floor and you've got the handheld calculator at shoulder height, and something goes wrong and you drop it onto a piece of concrete. The inside electronics and your handheld calculator might hit a number like 5,000 G's of deceleration at the instant the left-hand corner of your calculator struck the concrete. And unless somebody's done an extremely good job in the design, you're probably going to suffer some damage. In certain kinds of impacts, the instantaneous G-forces of acceleration or deceleration can really amaze you as to how big they get. And 2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, pretty amazing. I do appreciate the input of Glenn. Humoristic, and I was laughing. I would suggest to go to the subject number 2, which is Alford slotted line 21816. Effective.
Okay, I see that 2181-6 Alford slotted line, $16,130, 60 inches long, purchased for $150. Well, boy, somebody got a bargain. I bet you that guy lives in Queens.
Yeah, that was me, and actually the price was originally $6,000, and when I approached the guy, it was $3,000. So I called him, and I convinced him that he's not going to be able to sell it. So he sold it to me for the price that I said to him, $150, and the shipping is included.
That says that he hadn't gotten a whole lot of nibbles, because slotted lines used to be the exotic way of making precise measurements of impedance and frequency and all kinds of things, in roughly 1960. When I first came out of engineering school in 1964, and somebody wanted to know the exact swept impedance of a particular fancy piece of electronics, you got a real smart guy with a slotted line and a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, and you waited a week for him to measure all that data. And hopefully he didn't make any goof in all of the fancy calculations that are required to do it. Nowadays, a network analyzer will allow you to do all of those measurements in minutes that used to take almost a week. Now, a slotted line is still a useful device. There are places where it does some things that are very hard to do by other means. And when it comes to getting right down to the bedrock, if you really want to do science and you want to worry about all the fine details, there are times when a slotted line can get you a answer by which you can double-check what's happening with your network analyzer. There are times when a network analyzer can get fooled and it will lie to you, and I've been through a few of those. So I'm guessing you're about to use the slotted line as a double-check of your network analyzer to be sure you really know what's going on in certain situations. Is that approximately what's going on here, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. At first, I would ask you if you can explain to everybody what is the slotted line, but I already knew that before I have purchased that, you can measure the load impedance and the system flatness, you can measure the connector reflection antenna match in percentage of reflected power and standing wave magnitude and standing wave phase. Now, it's a completely mechanical device, does not have any electronic whatsoever. As far as the history of that, is that somewhere in 1950s, this was an extremely popular device, and Hewlett-Packard made the model 805 slot of mine, although, the lucky me, I was able to get a hold of something that is absolutely unique, that offered hertz to 4.5 gig. Let me drop. But what really amazed me in that was that this device could be used in quite very much exotic application. The characteristic of plasma beam created by means of a slotted line feed with 8F power in a magnetic mirror were studied in the range of neutral gas pressure, and the radial and axial profiles of the electron density and temperature of the floating potential and of the ion density were reported. And it can be seen that at the lowest pressure, the random energy of the electron is transformed into the actual energy of both electrons and ions. Now, do they have something in common with the vectors? That's interesting. So would you please explain to the audience what is actually that device? Back to you.
Yeah, Wesley owns a very interesting piece of history here. Alfred and Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, were making rather precise slotted lines at one time. A slotted line is a rather large diameter piece of air dielectric coaxial cable where there is a longitudinal slot in the outer conductor. Because the slot is parallel to the direction of propagation, parallel to the center conductor, the slot does essentially zero radiation. Your eye sees the center conductor, and you would think the radio wave would come squeaking out of there. It comes out of that slot. It doesn't. It's a beautiful shield, even though the slot is present. And one of the things you want to know about, with radio wave propagating in a transmission line, a coaxial cable, or when a radio wave is traveling through another kind of transmission line that you and I call air or free space. In both cases, the signal that flows from north to south and the signal that flows from south to north, those two signals do not see each other, do not react with each other in any way at all. That's opposite of common sense. The radio wave that travels from the left side to the right side of the slotted line and the radio wave that travels from the right side to the left side do not see each other, do not react with each other. I can have a signal generator on the left-hand side of the slotted line, another signal generator on the right-hand side of the slotted line, and they're both running at their frequency, at their amplitude, and nothing is happening in the middle of the slotted line because there are two separate signal generators on the opposite ends. Each signal generator, in theory, is a 50-ohm load, so each one of the signals from each signal generator flows down the slotted line, hits the other signal generator, which is a 50-ohm load, and gets absorbed. If they're ideal signal generators, there's no bouncing. But even though you've got two signals flowing in two directions, there's absolutely no interaction. At first, that is opposite of all reasonable common sense. Let me drop.
Next guy, question, next guy.
Yeah, I think I know what the question's going to be, so I'm going to guess ahead, and then I'm going to hand it to you. So there is no mixing of any kind of those two signals. Take my word for that. Or at least take it temporarily, swallow it, and don't digest it yet, if you know what I mean. Along comes this probe that you put into the slotted line. The probe is a kind of a quarter-wave monopole antenna, you could say. The probe is picking up some of the signal that flows from left to right. The probe is picking up some of the signal that flows from right to left. And many of these probes have got a tuning control on them, so you can tune it to the right frequency. But because the probe is a non-directional antenna, because the probe is sampling some of the signal that's flowing from left to right, and it samples some of the signal that's flowing from right to left, inside of the probe, for the first time, the two signals are being mixed together by way of the nonlinearity of the diode detector that's on that probe. Now the two signals are mixed together. And if, for instance, I've got those two signal generators phase-locked to each other, so that they're on the exact same frequency, or if the second signal really is a reflection from a poor load on the right-hand side, and there's a standing wave in there, so some of the signal that flows down there from left to right hits my poor load and reflects back. So by one means or another, I've got two separate signals, one going to the right, one going to the left, and they get mixed together for the first time inside of my probe, inside of that crystal detector. Now, as I move that probe along the slotted line, at some particular position, the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal are out of phase with each other, and at that position, I see a null in detected energy on my crystal detector. And I go to some other place, a quarter wavelength down the line, where the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I go to some other place on the line, a quarter wavelength further down, where the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal are now in phase with each other. I see a peak of signal on my crystal detector. And by measuring the magnitude of the peak and the magnitude of the valley, and with that the crystal detector electronics, the Hewlett-Packard 405, I think it is on enough, I keep it 415, the 415 crystal detector electronics, which has got beautiful linearity. It's got a rotary dial on the front that goes in 10 dB steps. And so I choose the right step, and I look at the needle, and I can measure the exact amplitude of the signal at the peak, and the exact amplitude of the signal in the valley, and the ratio of those two, we call it the standing wave ratio. So the crystal detector and the probe is what's mixing the two signals together for the first time, and you see the peak and the valley. In free space, that peak and the valley, you could say, doesn't exist. But another example of a probe I could use is my handy talkie. Let me drop. I'm standing in my bathroom in Huntington with my handy talkie in my hand. I'm listening to 146.85 in the morning while I'm shaving. And as I move the handy talkie around, the rubber duck is a probe. And some of that signal coming from Glen Oaks gets to Huntington, reflects off of my radio tower in the backyard, which is right alongside of the bathroom, and it's creating a standing wave. There are certain places in that bathroom where I hold the handy-talkie and I get no signal. And I move the handy-talkie a quarter of a wavelength to the left and to the right, I get a beautiful signal. On top of that, all the reflections that are happening from the wiring and the conduits and the plumbing and everything else in my house is creating a polarization shift. when I lay the handy talkie on the wooden shelf, on the plastic shelf that's in my bathroom, and I lay the handy talkie horizontal, I get a beautiful signal from Glen Oaks. When I put the handy talkie vertical, the signal disappears. So my handy talkie is a kind of a probe, and free space is a great big slotted line in my bathroom. That's just another example. You had a question about this, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I recall a long time ago, I saw the demonstration. I think it was in Brooklyn Tech. I think it was my senior year, of a commercial slotted line. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a statement made that slotted line measurement is that the line must be somewhere over one half wavelength long at the test frequency. Was that correct, over?
If you want to do it with no conversions, the answer is yes. You want the slotted line to be a half wave long so that you can see one peak, one valley, and the next peak as you move the probe. You'd like to be able to see a full wavelength of action, which happens to be a half wave in free space on the slotted line. However, if my slotted line is only a quarter wavelength long, and if I'm smart enough, I can use the slotted line, move it back and forth, and I'm going to find either a peak or a valley. And let's assume I find a valley. And in order for me to really be sure I know the frequency, I want to find the second valley. And I start moving the probe, and I run out of space on my slotted line that's too short. If I'm smart enough, and if I've got a well-calibrated piece of secondary cable, I can put another piece of cable between the slotted line and the load. And if my piece of cable is really known with enough accuracy as to its real electrical length, and if that extra piece of cable I add is high enough in quality that the cable and its connectors doesn't have any significant standing wave ratio of its own, then I can add that piece of cable. It's the equivalent of making a stretcher. I am now stretching the slotted line by adding that piece of cable. There's a whole lot of caveats here. Not many people do it this way. But in a pinch, you and I as amateurs can get an answer that's 97% accurate instead of 99% accurate, which is good enough. If I've got a high enough quality piece of cable that I've measured carefully enough, I can stretch that line by plugging in that extra piece of cable at the right period of time. Wonder if you see that process, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh yeah, I can see that. As I understand it, the slotted line started to fall by the wayside because they said it was not really a practical instrument, a practical way of making measurements on any frequency below 420 megahertz, because the full wavelength of 420 megahertz, being a full wavelength, is approximately 28 inches or less. So I understand that the instrument that replaced it, that became very popular, was the bridge-type standing wave indicator. Is that correct? In other words, you never see. In fact, is there any kind of standing wave indicators on the market that use a bridge-type indicator, Dick? You never see that, I don't think, over.
Oh, yes, you do. There was a fancy-looking device with a whole bunch of dials on it at right angles to each other, made by the General Radio Company, which was a kind of a bridge indicator. And by twisting those dials correctly and plugging in inductors and capacitors in the right spot, you were able to make rather precise standing wave ratio measurements, and you could with that device measure impedance. So in the very early days, we had Letcher wires, the shielded version of the Letcher wire, you and I call it a slotted line. The more compact version was this General Radio thing, this bridge-like thing, but all of that got replaced by the network analyzer. And you'll notice that whenever you did any of those measurements with a slotted line or this general radio bridge thing. It's got a fancy name, and I can't think of the name of it right now. You always had to go out and find a signal generator of the right frequency range. You had to go out and find a detector of the right frequency range. And you're always looking for signal generators and detectors over and over again. And some smart guy said, let's put the signal generator and the detector inside of one box. We're always getting these two things, putting them on the same shelf, on the same bench, day after day. Let's put the two things in the same box and calibrate them together. That made life a lot easier. And then somebody said, gee, since I've now got complete control of the signal generator and complete control of the detector, and I can make the detector a synchronous detector, where now it's capable of measuring amplitude and phase. Oh, boy. That, with the right kind of computer control, I can end a lot of the grief. When you were using that slotted line, let me drop. When you were using that slotted line, and you put a standard short circuit, open circuit, and 50-ohm termination on the end of it to calibrate your slotted line at your particular frequency. And then after you took off that short, the open, and the dummy load, and you put on your real unknown load, the null moved a certain number of centimeters to the left or to the right. And you then had to use Smith chart and calculations to figure out how many wavelengths toward the load or how many wavelengths toward the signal generator did the null move and how far did it move. And there's only a 50-50 chance you get it backwards when you're doing the calculations to try to figure out what was the real phase angle of the reflection off that load, what was the real amplitude of the reflection off that load, the standing wave ratio, the depth of the peaks and the valleys, and the movement of the null. You had to plug that into a whole bunch of three or four equations in sequence in order to make one measurement at one frequency as to what you thought the amount of resistive component and reactive component of that load was at that particular frequency. And boy, there's a lot of ways you can do it wrong. And the guy you're working for wants you to make the measurement at 50 frequencies between 420 and 460 megacycles. And you got to do all these calculations over and over again and hope you're not getting it backwards. A lot of work. And now with the network analyzer that measures all of the amplitudes and the phases and does it with a computer control, program that's built in there, and microprocessors, and displays it on the screen as a Smith chart, a swept frequency Smith chart on the screen. Wow. That saves you a tremendous amount of work. That only speeds up the process by about 1,000 to 1. If you've ever used a network analyzer, a good one, a modern one in the last 5 years, you'll say, how in the world have I ever lived without that? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You think you're 100% right. People don't know what we went through. And people still laugh at me a lot of times because I still have a slide rule. And because sometimes I don't trust my calculations. I got so, indoctrinated for so many years by using my slide rule that sometimes I'm checking my calculations that I do on my calculator back with the slide rule. I mean, I could say it was a misery. But, yeah, I remember that general radio. You brought up that GER that made that instrument in a fancy wooden box with that Bakelite panel, that black panel and everything. Oh, magnificent. But you would go batty. I know that thing. I know now. That's why I think I conveniently forgot about it. You go batty using it to dick. I don't bet you that if half a dozen people used it, you got half a dozen different people telling you different facts about what they measured over.
Yeah, that general radio bridge device had a very long learning curve and lots of ways you can go wrong with it. A slotted line was not quite as bad, but it still had a very significant learning curve. The number of people in the laboratory who you trusted to make a set of swept frequency measurements with good calibration procedures, with good display device, good graphing procedures. I mean, the engineers used to have to measure. They would fill up their notebook with all kinds of measurements and calculations, and then by hand they used to graph all this on polar chart paper to make a Smith chart. We went through a lot of work in those days. And now you can make, let me think, 10,000 measurements 30 times per second and display it in real time. You use a network analyzer today while you're tuning up an antenna, and you're making adjustments to the antenna, and every time you move a little component on the antenna, a thousandth of an inch, now I'm not kidding, and you watch the display update itself in a 30th of a second. It's updating so fast that you don't see the flickering, you don't see the flash. You just see the screen, you see the blue curve and the yellow curve on the screen move as your hand moves near that antenna. And you could be measuring the standing wave ratio, which is what I do with the yellow curve, and the gain of the antenna with the blue curve, and I'm measuring the two of them simultaneously in real time while it's sweeping across all the frequencies I care about. I could be sweeping that antenna from 50 megacycles to 5,000 megacycles inclusive, 30 times per second, and all that data is displayed on that screen. A man-month worth of data is being displayed on that screen every 30th of a second. And I'm not kidding. We've come a long way. And by way of computer automated procedures, you ain't seen the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
As I started to say, you ain't seen nothing yet. You've got a very interesting piece of history there, Wesley, and learning how to use it is going to teach you an awful lot about what's happening at the bedrock, of how that signal travels to the right, how the bouncing signal travels to the left, how the two signals don't mix together, they're thoroughly independent, whether it be in free space or inside of your slotted line, until they get picked up by that probe and rectified by that crystal detector, and then displayed on your Hewlett-Packard 415 standing wave ratio display device. Then the signals for the first time have been mixed together. And there's a slight exception to what I'm saying. That's on the assumption the medium is continuously operating in the linear manner. If I make the amplitude of that signal going down your slotted line big enough, because it's pulses coming out of a radar, and my radar is running at 10 megawatts pulses, and now I'm able to arc over the air, and the air acts in a non-linear manner. Now, for the first time, in the air, I will be mixing the signal that goes to the right with the signal that goes to the left because of the non-linearity. But under normal circumstances, Mother Nature keeps them completely separate. You say those words to the average engineer, and he says, I don't believe you. N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wesley?
Question?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick, Mel, everybody in the net. Dick, I have a question on the calibration kit that you had mentioned. There's an open device, a shorted device, and a proper termination, say 50 ohms. What is the purpose of the open device? Is it only a shield cap to prevent any type of coupling? What is its function? Excuse me, not quite well yet. If you could answer that for me, please.
Now, modern-day network analyzers have two or three different calibration procedures you can select when you're doing calibration. SLT, I think it's called. Short, load, termination, SLT, is one of the calibration procedures. In the case of the 50-ohm dummy load, no problem. In the case of the little thing in your hand with a connector, might be an SMA, a Precision, APC 3 or 5 or 7, whatever. The connector itself internally has a short or an open, but there's a catch. And that is, you have to be told ahead of time, because of the method of manufacture or the method of calibration of that calibrated termination device, you have to be told how many millimeters downrange from the front surface of the connector that's on that device. You have to be told how many millimeters downrange is the open circuit or is the short circuit. You may call it a short or an open, but it's got a certain length. It's got to have internal length to hold itself together, to support that semiconductor, if you know what I mean. So you're told ahead of time that maybe it's 5 millimeters downrange from the front surface of that connector. That's where the open is. If you had X-ray vision, you would see the semiconductor of your cable become, go, you're walking along there and you see the semiconductor of the connector.